Okay, I think it's going to work now.
Okay.
So, today is December 9th, 2020, and this is Karen Brewster, and I'm here with Kathy Spooty, and wait, I need to turn on the Zoom recording, so it's going to give us a little messagey thing.
This meeting is being recorded.
Okay. So, now, this is Karen Brewster, December 9th, 2020, and I'm here with Kathy Spooty for the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park Oral History Project. So thank you, Kathy, for joining me by Zoom from Santa Fe.
Sure. I'm glad we were finally able to do it.
Because I know.
I was so disappointed to miss out.
I know. I was very disappointed to have missed you when I was there. What was that?
Yeah.
May of 2019. Yeah. So thank you for being willing to try this again.
Sure.
And I will say, well, probably will come up, but that your maiden name was Blee, so many of your publications about Skagway are in that name, as well as Spooty, correct?
Actually, my maiden name is Holder.
Oh.
And that was my first married name. So when I married Bob, I didn't think I needed to keep that other guy's name.
No.
So.
Right. So sometimes you are referred to as Kathy Holder, sometimes Kathy Blee, sometimes Kathy Spooty.
Right.
Just to confuse things.
Just to confuse things. The Library of Congress called me up one day and said, are you Catherine Blee and also Catherine Holder? And so they had picked that up and had cross-referenced it all. So.
Yes. Well, that's what happens when we change our names when we get married, I guess.
Yeah.
So, to get us started, maybe you could tell me a little bit about yourself, your background, where you're from, where you grew up.
Well, that's a good place, where I grew up. I'm second generation Park Service. My dad worked for the National Park Service, and so I grew up in a variety of national parks. He transferred every 2 or 3 years, that sort of thing. By the time I got ready to go to college, I was in Colorado, or he was in Colorado, and I went to Colorado State University for my bachelor's degree in anthropology, and then much later, after several years, I went back to graduate school at the University of Colorado Boulder to get both my master's and my PhD. Both, again, all in anthropology, which has an archaeology specialty. So, and I, Dad made me sign up to take a PACE exam back in 1974, just as I was getting ready to start my senior year in college. That was, I forget what the acronym stands for. It's Professional and Career Exam. That's what the PACE exam is. And it was the way back in the 70s that you had to take the exam in order to begin to qualify for being put on hiring lists for the federal government, that sort of thing. So about, 9 months or so after I took the test, out of the blue, I get a call from the Denver Service Center asking me if I wanted to have it come down for an interview. And I was hired in November of 1975. And my whole Park Service career, or my whole professional career, was with the National Park Service.
Okay. And what made you decide to go into anthropology and archaeology?
Well, actually, I left out that one little. I spent 1 year at Mary Washington College in Virginia, and they had this wonderful course on Greek history and another one on Roman history that I took for my electives. And in those, and then I just, you know, fell in love with the whole idea of working outdoors under the sun and digging up old ruins and stuff like that. And it ended up not being quite like that, but it still got me started.
And so when did you earn your master's and your PhDs?
Let me see. I think I got my master's was in 85, and then I got my PhD in 91. And I went straight from the master's courses into my PhD courses. So.
And what did you do for your PhD?
Oh, for my PhD thesis, I did a, I took the excavations that I'd done in Skagway, the data from them, and compared them to excavations of similar time periods across the entire United States. I forget how many artifact assemblages I looked at, but developed a predictive model so that you, out of which you could look, dig in a dump, for instance, which you knew to be kind of a mixed deposit, and then through complicated statistic could parse out how much of that deposit was coming from different kinds of socioeconomic contributors. And so that was kind of how I started looking at households as different from hotels, different from saloons, different from prostitutes. And it was all geared towards a trash dump that we'd dug up in Skagway, which was on Sixth Avenue and very close to the saloon section of town and to the prostitute section of town. And I also looked at army deposits because the army had some barracks very close to that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, kind of as a result of that, I sort of pioneered a new method of making predictions. I haven't seen it used a whole lot by a lot of people because the statistics are so complicated that even archaeologists shy away from. And it did take me a while to get a handle on how to do that statistic.
Yeah. So. Well, and that was a dump site that was that Father Turnell's, or that was a different one?
No, it was next to the Peniel Mission.
Oh, okay.
And it actually predated the Peniel Mission by a year or so, and then continued to get some deposits in it after the mission was built and the building right next to it was built. And so it was interesting to look at it. And my statistic told me it was a combination of family households and a hotel type of assemblage with a little bit of a contribution by prostitutes. I didn't really understand that prostitutes thing until many years later. And I was reading in the old newspapers that there actually was a brothel right next door to the Peniel Mission.
Oh.
Only in use when the Peniel missionaries were out of town.
I was going to say, it was interesting neighbors.
So actually my method did work, and I got some historic confirmation of it at a later time, which was infinitely pleasing to me to do that.
That's great. Well, I think eventually I'm going to ask you about digging in dumps and outhouses, but we'll get to that. I'm going to kind of keep us moving forward in a timeline, at least at the beginning here. So you got the job at the Denver Service Center in 1975, doing what?
I was hired to do actual excavations, but did them in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. That was right before the bicentennial of 1976. And there were a number of buildings in Harpers Ferry that were going to be, that got a lot of funding right that. The goal had been to try to finish the renovations or the rehabilitations before the bicentennial. Everything, and waiting until 75 to get some archaeologists going on it was a little ridiculous. So it turned out to be more salvage archaeology, quickly going in and digging up what we could. And it was very instructive. I'd never done historical archaeology, but there weren't very many archaeologists that had in the 70s. So I really wasn't out of my league that much. And then I think in about 79, no, late 78, projects started coming up in Alaska where the funding was coming through for, first of all, it was for the Russian Bishop's House in Sitka. And so they had me go out there and do a little bit of excavations for that. And then in late 78, I made my first trip to Skagway because they were digging some holes, back holes in the ground to do soils tests in preparation for starting to put new foundations under the buildings. And I just went out there for a week to watch them do that and did some profiles, some stratigraphic profiles and that kind of stuff. And so that was the first time, that ridiculous time of year to be going out there was late October. I could see the stratigraphic profiles for all of maybe 4 hours every day because it was so dark.
No. I thought
so.
It was-
I learned right then. That was a learning curve right there. Is you don't work during the dark time in Alaska.
I thought you would say that late October was that it was sort of freezing rain and
cold. Well, it was. I mean, I flew in and flew out without ever seeing the mountains around Skagway. Yeah. The entire time I was there, the first trip.
I've been there in October when it was beautiful, but yes, lovely.
Well, I went back in April of 79, and it was absolutely marvelous. It was gorgeous. The poor woman that I remember was helping do some excavations in that little cul-de-sac in the depot building, you know, area between the two buildings. She was, it was so frozen back there that she'd warm up the soil with her butt by sitting on it. And then she'd go and scrape a little bit.
That's creative.
That was another learning curve, is you don't do excavations in April unless you've got a way to thaw out the ground better than a person's butt.
Yeah. Especially if it's ground under a building, I think it would take even longer to thaw.
Yeah. Well, and at the time it was kind of a light well.
It didn't have the decking over it.
It didn't have the decking over it. It didn't have a roof or anything over it. So it wasn't really underground. But I was doing other tests under the building itself, and that was fine. It was just that one particular area didn't get any sunlight ever.
Well, as I said that about, well, under the building would be more frozen. Actually, maybe it was less frozen because it was insulated and it didn't freeze as deeply.
Well, in those days, we're talking about original floors, original foundations in those days. So the depot was a little better because they were actually using it in one form or another at the time. And so parts of it were heated. And then by that time, under the floors would have been much better off.
Okay.
Those were the first times I went. And again, learning curves. And of course, architects need the information that they want, or they want to go ahead and do the, they were chomping at the bit to actually get new good foundations under those buildings as fast as they could. And of course, the replacement of the foundations was the thing that was going to cause the most damage if there was any archaeology under the buildings. So there was a lot of pressure on us to do a lot of work right at first. And not necessarily at prime times of year to be doing it.
So how many buildings did you have to do that first year?
Oh, well, that first year I was still doing, and I was still in kind of a testing mode, just trying to, and I was responding to requests by supervisors who really didn't know what they were doing. And I, you know, I was kind of low person on the totem pole in that time. I think I was a GS9 by that time, but I didn't have a whole lot of say on when I could go and what I could do. It's just I'd be told that there's so much money and you got to go look in these places. And so I would design where I was going to put the trenches based on how much money was available, instead of having input to begin with on saying, yeah, these kinds of projects really optimally you need to have a little lead time on them, and figure out what's the best way to invest the money and that sort of thing. But those first couple of times it was only two or three of the earliest buildings that they were working on. They went in right away and did the foundations of the Mascot Saloon without even asking for any archaeological work. That was one of the first buildings they worked on. And by that time, the archaeologists in the regional office began to realize what was going down in Skagway and said, hey, wait a second. We need to do a little bit of archaeology before you just start pouring foundations right and left. So
yeah, I'm surprised that the architects and the people working on those first restorations didn't know about 106 compliance, that they had to do those projects, or was that not a requirement yet in the 70s?
Well, you know, the late 70s was a little late, a little early for really getting our act together on Section 106 compliance. The Section 106 compliance was something more in the field of the architects. And so they were careful about the recording the building before they tore anything down. But it just didn't occur to them that there'd be anything under the buildings that they might want to look at. And heaven forbid that it might actually contribute to their knowledge of what was going on in the building.
Yeah. Well, and as you said, historic archaeology was in its early stages. I think
it
most
was in
people
its infancy.
Thought, oh, archaeology, as you say, it's digging up old ruins in Greece or something, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think the Society for Historical Archaeology was first created in about 1975, and they were all colonial. You know, to be looking at something that was from effectively the 20th century was beyond any, you know, why would you ever do something like that?
Right.
Sort of thing.
Right. That's not history, right?
Yeah.
It's still the present.
It's like, I know somebody who's still alive, who was alive at that point.
Right. So you were not in charge of the archaeology program then. You were just assigned to it?
I was just the field archaeologist who was doing the work. And after a few years, they began to realize that I kind of had a better handle. Both the regional office and my office began to realize they kind of had a handle on what was going on. And they'd ask my opinion on maybe what we should be doing next year or the year afterwards. And the regional office controlled the funding and where money that they called it type 42 money, which was archaeological investigations, preliminary excavations. And let's see, type 43 money was money that would be used during the construction phase itself. And it really wasn't until the early to mid 80s that the regional office and the Denver Service Center got coordinated enough that the money was coming in at the time at the same time of year as the money was going in for the architectural designs and for the what construction projects were starting to happen and that sort of thing.
Well, like do the archaeology this summer before you're going to do the foundation.
Yeah, good idea. In fact, you know, in my tenure at the Denver Service Center, these were the only projects I was actively doing field work with, but the rest of my job was involved in coordinating between archaeologists who would be doing field work and the design process that was going on in the Denver Service Center. And so and it was kind of a delicate balance on when do you have enough information from the designers after preliminary design is done to have an idea where impacts are going to be. But then to do the archaeology before they get into final design, so you still got time that if there is a significant feature or significant deposit down there, that they can change their mind about how they're going to get it done. And so that was kind of a learning process for, I think, for the profession as a whole, for the Denver Service Center, for the regional office. I think the 1980s were very significant in terms of making progress in that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And of course, by the time the end of the 80s came along, I had such a backlog of stuff I needed to do reports on. That's about when I stopped. We started hiring people who could devote their time specifically to a project and be hired for that project and not be having to go back to Denver and ship up a bunch of artifacts back and forth and then split my time half and half between writing up reports and doing the rest of the coordination work I had to do at the service center.
And why was the service center hired to do the archaeology? Why was it not done through park staff or regional office staff?
Well, in those days, the function of the Denver Service Center was to do all design and construction, planning, design, and construction for the National Park Service. That function has changed since, but so the monies were always targeted for the Denver Service Center to begin with, anytime there was a big... Now, I mean, the regional office's staff could sometimes pull smaller projects in, but they just didn't have the staffing capability to be able to handle these, some of them were multi-million dollar projects that we were doing. I don't think anything at Klondike ever cost that much, but, you know, several hundred thousand would come in every year. And I'd be lucky to get 20 or 25,000 of it. So,
well, I suppose an example might be a park building a new visitor center, something like that. That could be a multi-million dollar effort.
Yes, and for instance, we did the design on all the new housing at the Grand Canyon back in the 90s. And that was a whole housing development sort of thing.
Okay.
And visitor centers, yes. We did the designs on the visitor centers. And because we had a good staff of historical architects, they ended up doing design, recording of buildings, and then design of how to do rehabilitations for projects all over the country. Again, a lot of them were back east during the bicentennial. Mm-hmm. Later, Alaska was kind of a little late in the process, but between Sitka and Klondike, there were plenty of need.
Well, and to say, you know, I forget that we're still talking about the late 70s and early 80s, and
yes,
all the big park units didn't get established in Alaska till 1980. So
you're right.
I can see where there was that delay.
Yeah, and so you're coming out of the Anelka studies and Klondike wasn't, I forget when Klondike was established, but it was only like 78 or something.
Yeah, 76, 78, somewhere in there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't remember either. But yeah, and I guess, too, the Park Service, like many organizations, you know, it changes, and there was a period where it was all centralized, and then, okay, no, now those duties go back out to the parks. I mean, and it's still happening. It's parks versus regional offices.
Yeah.
They're always doing that.
My memory is that 1995 was a big reorganization of the Park Service in which there was a major effort made to take a lot of that kind of work back into the regional offices and then to parse it out to the parks too.
Right.
Which actually, you know, there's benefits to both ways of doing it. you know, my job certainly got a lot easier once all of that happened, because then I could focus in more on coordination roles and less on having my time divided between professional work and just the paperwork that needed to be done in connection to all these, the compliance, basically, right, trying to make sure the compliance was done.
And you mentioned the historic architects, that the first historic architect doing work up in Skagway, wasn't that Dave Snow out of the Denver Service
Center? No, it was Gary Higgins.
Oh, okay.
And Gary was... But Gary was out of the Denver Service Center, and I knew Gary, and he knew me. I mean, we all knew each other down right there. So, and he was a wonderful guy to be starting up all of that stuff. And then I think that Dave Snow came along to fill in Gary's place when Gary left.
Right. But the fact that all of you were coming from the Denver Service Center in those early years.
Right, right.
Right. So when you were out in Skagway doing field work, how many other people were helping you?
I learned to hire a crew of about 5 or 6. I think the first couple of years I maybe only had 2 or 3 people helping me. And then I'd go for a longer period of time. And then I learned, if I could do my sessions in maybe a 4-week period, 4 or 5 week period, I could hire a lot better qualified people, because they were happy to take a short break from the real job and make enough money to go to Alaska and back and have that Alaska experience. And usually that's about all the money they'd make, is enough to meet their expenses. But every single one of them would be very well qualified and top-notch people. So that was part of that learning curve that I went through.
So you didn't hire students for the summer?
I always advertised the jobs for students. But because my sessions were so short, the students would usually say, no, I want a summer job. I want it to go all summer long. I want it to go from June, July, August, and into September. And I don't want this thing starting late May and ending in the end of June, so that I could meet the schedule of the rest of the architects, the design schedule, you know.
Okay. Yeah, that was my question, is why did your season, why was it a short excavation season?
Well, I suppose I could have made it all summer long, but then I would have had to do it all by myself.
Well, no, I guess...
A lot of times, it was money, you know.
Okay.
It was trying to find the most efficient way to make the money work.
Okay.
And get the most work done. So
it was limited by how much, you only had so much funding, and it wasn't enough to last for a full summer's worth
right,
of work.
Right, okay. Right. And that's what I was saying before, is I very rarely, at least in the early days, had any input into the amount of funding that would be available. These were figures that were probably pulled out of a hat by a person in Seattle, the very early ones. There was an archaeologist in Seattle who was actually making these numbers up out of whole cloth. And
well, then they probably didn't have a lot to base it on if nobody had been doing this kind of work before.
No.
So some of the early projects you work on, you mentioned the depot and the mascot. So which was your first one, the depot?
Oh, the depot was one of the first places I took a look under the ground. Also looked behind the mascot. I didn't go under the mascot saloon at first. I looked at where they were going to move the Martin Itchen house and where it is sitting now, but at the time it was sitting someplace else. And what else did I look at? There was a hole that was dug in the back of the Lynch and Kennedy building. And so I had a little input into that original work that was done at the Lynch and Kennedy building. And then it moved on to, in later years, to the Moore House, more focus on the Moore House and the Moore Cabin. And let's see, then from the Moore House and Moore Cabin, Block 24, which is now where you guys have, the park has several little temporary buildings that were brought in.
It's not where the maintenance building is?
No, Block 24 is where you know where the Peniel Mission is, uh-huh. And then the Moore House and the Moore Cabin. It would be just to the west of the Moore House and Moore Cabin. It was a big open space at the time.
Oh, it's where,
now
it's
you've
where
got the Goldberg Cigar Store on that those lots. The ice
house.
And the Boss Bakery.
Right.
And I guess I don't know if you've done it yet. They've done it yet or not? But they were going to move those cribs in onto that space too.
The cribs are in an alley.
That alley bisected Block 24.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. And so I did a bunch of work on Block 24, which was more just I just stuck a whole bunch of holes, little round holes going down to, two or 3 feet deep to just get an idea of what the stratigraphy was like in there and to see if there was any way we might be able to figure out if there were physical remains of the White Pass Trail that went through there. Because at first the trail cut right in front of the Moore House and then went off to an angle over towards the river. And that was when I discovered Father Turnell's trash pit and just hit upon it accidentally. Again, I wasn't getting enough notice on what I needed to do, and I wasn't in the park, so I couldn't do a good history study of these things oriented towards where things actually were that aren't there anymore. And by the time the 90s came along, we'd kind of figured out you need to spend 2 or 3 months really going through those historic photographs, going through the deed records, getting a very detailed look at the use of a certain parcel of land through time and what your chances, and then figure out where you wanted to put your trenches and holes and that stuff sort of stuff into the ground. So Father Turnell's trash pit was pure luck in terms of finding that. Didn't even know it was going to be there.
Yeah, interesting that you would do all that historical research to figure out how a piece of land was used that would guide you. I never thought about that.
Well, later we got to doing that, but at first we were acting like we were prehistoric, doing archaeology the way that prehistoric archaeologists did, which is just go out and see what you can see on the surface of the ground and then dig and see what you can find. Mm-hmm. And historical archaeology, you can do it a whole lot better than that, know a whole lot more about what you're going to be looking for if you just do your homework first.
Mm-hmm. But under the buildings, did that work the same way, or how How did you do it under the buildings?
Well, under the buildings, you know, because they moved things around so much, sometimes the buildings aren't on their original site, and so you kind of want to know what was there before. And I did kind of learn through my learning, through my experience, that buildings themselves kind of act as a, I call them artifact magnets, because the way the foundations were in Skagway, they're just little piers, and the buildings kind of stuck up above the ground on piers, so there was always an open space under it, and so bottles and trash and stuff like that would get kicked under the building and never get picked up. And as a result, you can find a lot of stuff under buildings. In the Mascot Saloon, when the regional office finally in, God, when was that? I think it was 89 or 90. They, Paul Gleason and Carl Gerke was hired about that time. And the two of them went under the Mascot Saloon and tried to see if there was anything left after the foundations were put in. And they did find a lot of deposits down there that had been undisturbed. And so that turned out to be a much more, a very exciting kind of excavation. You sent out several questions to me ahead of time.
Right.
And I had the pleasure of getting to write up their results for that excavation. It was by far, for me, the most interesting excavation that was done in Skagway, period. Although I wasn't the one that directed it.
You know, what's interesting, I didn't realize that they did that after the new foundation had already been put in.
Right, right.
I mean, I knew they did that work, but I thought it was clearance like all the other ones.
No, uh-uh. And and again, the disturbance took place right within a couple of feet of each of the foundations. So the area, and then there's some piers in the middle of it too that are also holding things up. But there was enough space in and around that, and then a very nice layer of a glacial, I forget what they called it, it was a clay-like deposit that they thought was a glacier laid, and I became convinced it was more flood deposits. That there are several times when the streets flooded, and because it was a low-lying area underneath the saloon, that some flood deposits would get down in there. Though Paul and I still will disagree to that to the day we both pass on. So he's entitled to his opinion. I'm entitled to mine. I got to have the say because I wrote up the report.
Well, and didn't was it the mascot that Ted Burkardall did a follow-up thing
yes,
on?
Yes, I was a little upset about that because...
I don't now remember what it said, but...
Well, he came in on the side of Paul, but it's like he was given plenty of chance to review that draft many, many times, and he didn't come up with any of this until after he retired, and so it's kind of like, well... If you felt that strongly about it, why didn't you tell me when you had a chance?
And I don't remember what
impact.
Yeah, I don't remember what his perspective was on it.
His perspective was basically that was a flood deposit, not a flood plot, that was a glacial till, that there had been an earlier saloon at that place. And my contention has always been that no, there was never an earlier saloon, that the saloon, the artifacts related to the saloon were actually related to the very earliest Mascot Saloon, which was a wooden building.
Okay.
And to tell you the truth, it really doesn't matter. You know, it's not that important.
Well, isn't that sort of the nature of science and, you know, research, that people can come up with different answers sometimes?
Yeah, and the thing is, he wrote a 50-page rebuttal to my report, and I haven't done archaeology since I retired. Or, no, I did do some consulting with some other firms, but at least since 2010, I haven't done any archaeology. And I was not at the point where I even wanted to read those 50 pages.
Yeah.
So we'll just let the record stand the way it is.
Okay. So why did you find that to be the most interesting project?
Oh, just the artifacts. There was a sort of stratigraphy. It was more of what we all called a horizontal stratigraphy, because the deposits that were under the front part of the building were the oldest. And then because the back part of the building wasn't built till 1904, see? So everything behind the building post-dated 1904, whereas everything under the building was confined to about an 1897 to 1901 time period. And then, well, I guess the next part of the building was more of a 1901 to 1904 time period. And then further back, it was 1904 to and later. And I could really see differences in the distribution of, say, whiskey bottles. There were a lot more whiskey bottles earlier on during the gold rush period. It was mostly beer bottles and nickels. Okay, so during the gold rush period, it was whiskey bottles, poker chips, dice, and what was the other thing? Oyster shells. Whereas when you got to the later period, when it was a working class bar associated with the railroad, it was beer bottles, it was nickels. They weren't gambling with poker chips anymore. They were gambling with nickels, if they were gambling, and a nickel is how much a beer costs too. So, and then peanut shells.
Oh, so the peanut shells were the later period.
The peanut shells were from the later period. And whereas the oysters, you can see the oysters, they had a cachet. Oysters weren't that much more expensive than other things were, but there was a perception that if you could dine on oysters, that you would hit the big money already.
Oh, I see.
Were they
local oysters? Do oysters grow out in the bay?
No, I think they were brought up from the Seattle area. Probably they were imported. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very interesting in all of the work you've done how it shows the sort of social cultural world above the ground that was going on that left these artifacts.
And that's what I was trying to focus in on as I did my dissertation, is I really wanted to show how the artifacts aren't just a really cool spoon or a coin that you find in the ground, but the assemblage as a whole can tell you about the culture of the people that are using it. And mm-hmm.
Well, is that true for all types of archaeology, or is that specific to historic archaeology?
Oh, I think all types of archaeology. If you've got people who are really trying to do it for research, I wasn't really able to do any of that for the compliance portion of it because there just wasn't the money for it. But by taking the data and then using it in a real research context, like I did for my dissertation, and then later for the book that I helped pull together, called El Dorado, The Archaeology of Gold Rushes in the Far North. Carl Gerke helped me with that, and then Robin Mills, who is a BLM archaeologist up in Fairbanks. The three of us got together and came up with a bunch of what really I think is the compendium on historical archaeology in Alaska. And I think a lot of people up there use it today.
I hope so.
Kind of an outline of how to frame research questions and follow up on them. If you've got the luxury of being able to do true research outside of just picking up a bunch of artifacts and putting them in the museum somewhere, you know.
Well, and your Father Tunnell project relates to that too. I was fascinated when I read it about the medicine bottles and you're dating these bottles and how much goes into that.
Yeah, and what's your question?
Oh, it's just that how much you can tell from just a bottle, but you have to figure out the bottle's history
to help tell
the story.
The bottle information there, we had help from the Midwest Archaeological Center. They did the artifact analysis on that project for me. And I just did some absolutely beautiful drawings. I don't know if you've seen in those days, it was so expensive to publish color pictures. And I never thought the black and white pictures photocopied very well. Mm-hmm. I liked the pen and ink drawings because they were the easiest to make copies of if people wanted a copy of the report and that sort of thing. And MIDWAC did an incredible job with those drawings and doing the research on digging the bottles and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and this does relate with sort of going off on tangents, but with those bottles and the story you told about that maybe they were being used as being used for drinking them for alcohol rather than using them as medicine, how do you tell how the contents might have been used in a social context?
Now, I don't remember that being one of my conclusions for the Father Turnell stretch bit. Generally, I'd say it was in context. Now, are you sure you're not confusing it with Doreen Cooper's work at the Morehouse that she did later?
I might be.
It is. Now that I come to think of it, she found a privy pit that had a lot of medicine bottles in it. And I think she thought that they were probably being used for their alcohol content more than medicinal purposes. Yeah.
Okay. So that, I'm sorry, I got the two confused.
So you'd have to ask Doreen.
Yeah. Well, I have interviewed Doreen and I don't remember if I asked her that or not.
Yeah.
But I guess it is sort of leads to the question of how do you figure out what the story is behind an object that you find?
Yeah. I think you have to make assumptions and educated assumptions that are based on work that other people have done, you know, and one of the main things I did in my dissertation was try to demonstrate how it's really important to figure out the function of an artifact and how it is used within the context of other activities or within its social context, and that you can't always say that a pair of scissors is always going to be used to do the same things. In some places, a pair of scissors might be used to cut hair, and you may make that assumption based on the fact they're finding razor straps and hair tonic for men and that sort of thing. In another place, you might assume that they're being used to cut cloth if you're finding a lot of pins and needles and buttons and that kind of stuff. So it's looking at everything in context with each other. And when you go back to Father Turnell's trash pit, there were tons of bottles down there. Very many of them were Welch's grape juice bottles. And then it turned out when I finally did have the luxury of looking at the historic photographs and finding out a little something about Father Turnell himself, that that he had been one of the prominent people to sign a temperance ordinance or request for temperance in the town. But at the same time, you could tell that he, in his private life, was drinking. There was gin and wine bottles and rum bottles and other things like that in his trash pit. But because he had so much grape juice, it was pretty obvious he just felt he needed to substitute something for his habit. And it could very well have been that he became temperate and did it by drinking a glass of grape juice, because he always had to have something to drink with dinner, you know.
It wasn't that the wine, that the grape juice was replacing wine in a religious ceremony.
No, because this trash pit was back behind his house.
Okay.
There was a separate one that was back behind the church, and we never found it. It may still be out there. But if he was dumping anything down his, the end of the, well, I think even the church, by that time they had trash haulers. I think the only reason we were getting liquor bottles and bottles of any kind down in Father Turnell's trash pit is he didn't want people knowing that he was throwing liquor bottles away.
All right.
Yeah.
Because I was wondering, yeah, that you call it a trash pit, but was it also an outhouse hole?
It was an outhouse hole. But what they did was he got, I think it was in 1914, he connected up to the city water system so that he got indoor plumbing. And that's when the privy pit was abandoned. They probably tore down the privy and filled up, and he just filled it up full of trash.
Right.
That he had in his house.
Right. Yeah. 1914, is that early for indoor plumbing in a city system?
Oh, I don't know. The city of Skagway had a water system clear back in 1898.
Oh.
Was when they started building their water system. Mm-hmm. And people started getting indoor plumbing if they could afford it right away. So,
yeah. Well, I didn't realize it was that early. We were talking before about being a Denver Service Center employee versus a park employee, and you mentioned sort of pros and cons, but maybe we can... You didn't mention them. You mentioned there were pros and cons to being from outside working on these projects.
Well,
can you talk about that?
Yeah, but... I think the cons for someone, well, the cons of having somebody park-based at first would have been having a place to work. later the park, once the Mascot Saloon renovations were done, they were able to use the upstairs of the Mascot Saloon for their laboratory. And while I was in the field, I just would do very, very rough processing of artifacts in whatever space I could find. And it was whatever space wasn't being used for some other purpose. But it was very low priority on anybody's part to make for the 4 to 6 weeks I was going to be trying to make the money last as long as it would last.
So the Park Service didn't really have offices there, is what you're saying?
They didn't. Well, they, yeah.
Minimally.
They had that office up above the grocery store and until they were able to get the depot building renovated to a point where they could actually put offices in it. Mm-hmm. So they were renting space, decent space in order to even have offices.
Right. So you sent all the artifacts back down to Denver every summer?
Yep. I'd pack them up in boxes and mail them. And they somehow always got there okay. and then at the service center, we were allowed some fairly good space, but it wasn't very secure. I mean, the curators today would have had an absolute fit. And I do think that I know that two or three nice items from Skagway ended up being taken by somebody just walking through.
That's too bad.
Yeah.
So when you came to Skagway as a Denver Service Center employee, what was the response from the Skagway-based employees?
Well, at the time, we always had a lot of cooperation from the people in the park. I had one, you know, again, one of these learning curve things is that I borrow the shovels and wheelbarrows and the kinds of stuff like that that we would be using from the maintenance, the facilities, people working for facilities management. And inevitably I'd show up to work one day and whatever wheelbarrow I was using would be gone. Well, facilities needed that day. So after that, I used my parsimonious funds to buy wheelbarrows and shovels ahead of time so that they couldn't come and claim my wheelbarrow. But those, you know, those are minor little things. You kind of, you learn how to get around them. It would be frustrating to have to go chasing all over Skagway on foot from building to building to look for my wheelbarrow because I needed it.
And they would say it was their wheelbarrow in the first place.
They'd say it was their wheelbarrow. Mm-hmm.
So were there...
But then what I'd do is I'd buy wheelbarrows and shovels and then I'd give it to the park when I leave. And then I think after doing that for two or three years, they said, yeah, those are your wheelbarrows. Those are your shovels.
So you said one of the difficulties was no place to work. And so there was a benefit to being able to go back to Denver for the processing. Were there other pros and cons of coming from elsewhere? And
well, I think for the, you know, in the long run, the fact that they did get a park archaeologist made them realize, it was about the time they realized that it is a full-time job for somebody and that it was much more efficient in the long run. And the money would go a lot further in the long run if you just hired someone and stationed them in Skagway year round. And that's what they did with Carl Gerke. And then as more and more renovation projects were getting funded, they were able to hire Doreen Cooper as well, and would hire then, and Carl and Doreen then would hire crews that would stay on all summer, like you were saying. Mm-hmm. And the park also realized that they had a little bit of an obligation to provide some housing for people. I didn't have any housing. First few times I went there, I hired people from the Denver area and paid for their transportation up there so that I could give them per diem. Later on, when I used larger crews, I said, you guys are going to have to get there by yourself. You're going to have to find a place to live in Skagway yourself. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't an ideal kind of thing. The whole crew did that one summer find a house to rent together, but it had very little furniture in it. I think they were sleeping on the floors and in their sleeping bags and that kind of stuff. And it was less than ideal situation. But it was just learning curve, you know. As the park itself got more and more money and got trailers in there for housing. They fixed up the Peniel Mission and used that for housing for temporary employees for a while and that kind of stuff. It became much more logical that you'd have staff archaeologist making all those kinds of arrangements. Yeah,
I didn't think about it, that even going up there for 4 weeks in the summer, where would you stay before the Park Service had all their facilities?
Yeah, well, and I very early on found a wonderful couple who were empty nesters and had a big house. And they charged us room and board, very minimal, way below per diem. And so I was able to save money on the for other things by housing them at Paul and Alice's place. And I think their names were Paul and Alice Sear, and Jay. Oh, his name was on my
cable.
The chief ranger,
Jay Cable,
bought their house from them when they left. But so, you know, it was all kind of in the family.
Well, I've certainly heard Paul and Alice's name, and her name comes up a lot in connection with the park and the railroad and providing historical information.
Yeah, well, Paul, you know, Paul's father came with the gold rush. And which was amazing. His father must have been very old when Paul was born. And then Paul was in his 60s when we were there in the 80s. He has since passed on. But so he had a long, long history. He'd worked with the railroad ever since he could walk practically. And he was a great source of information, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So we talked about the mascot being interesting. Any other special projects that you've worked on?
Well, the others, you know, to tell you the truth, the others are also kind of not complete. They were more just, hole here, a hole there, trying to make sense of what we were doing. It wasn't well. And then when we found the Peniel, the dump at the Peniel Mission, that was really interesting. And we were able to go. I was able to go back and get some, do some additional digging there. One of the fun ones was the attic in the Moore cabin. I don't know, someone showed me, was just doing a tour, and I went up and looked in the attic, and it looked like there was an inch or two of dirt on the floor of the attic. And I started poking around in, and it turned out it was just accumulated dust from the past 100 years or so. And so I said, I'm going to do an excavation up here. And with a little experimentation, I figured out I could excavate with a vacuum cleaner.
Wow.
And also learned how not to suck the nails up or anything up, you know, to be really careful when I was vacuuming. And so I vacuumed I gritted off the inside of the mascot. I vacuumed it all up. I plotted out every nail and every little thing that I found in there. And a lot of it was the stuff that you stick in, my brain's not giving me the right word, stuck in between the logs.
Chinking?
The chinking, yes. They'd use cloth chinking between the logs up there. And it turned out if you unrolled the piece of cloth and looked at it really carefully, you could begin to figure out what garments had been torn up as rags. And almost always they were places that they were like the areas that were seams. So it looked to me like that Mrs. Moore,
Nellie.
Bernard Moore's wife, Minnie Moore, who was the woman who was living there at the time that the cabin was built, was probably using the upper the flat places of clothing as rags of one kind or another. And then all that got left over was the stuff at the seams. And then her husband picked up that waste stuff, instead of throwing it away, used it as chinking in the cabin. Again, it's just, you know, it's pretty soon you can figure all this stuff out, and it's just fascinating.
Yeah, well, that reminds me, I have a friend who up in Utqiagvik in Barrow, where her house was an old part of a ship, and when that was refurbished, they found in between all the boards old wadded up newspapers.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting.
And of course, you know, the Moore cabin had been papered with newspapers,
right,
in the bottom section in the main room down below.
Right. Yeah. So did you do any of the archaeology on the ground at the Moore property?
Yeah, that was all Doreen. I did right back behind the Moore house, and found the trenches that would have surrounded the cabin itself. See, the cabin was originally behind Moore House, and then it got moved over to where it is now. And I found the trenches that had been used the logs had sat down in, and then they mound up dirt on the sides. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that was kind of neat.
did you find any interesting artifacts, or was just the trenches?
It was mostly just the trenches. I did find a couple of little items that could have been made by Tlingit Indians in the area. They were carved wood or carved bone. One looked like it was part of a harpoon hook. And I forget what the other one was. We're talking almost 30 years ago now, so my brain doesn't remember all that.
But that does bring up the
if
point.
If you really want to know, you can look in the report.
Yeah, well, the report gives the basics. The talking about it gives the feelings of it.
Yeah.
And the experience of it. But that does bring up the question about the Tlingit history in that area. You know, we mostly hear that they were more out in Dyea than in Skagway, per se.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah. Even Moore himself taught in his little book that he wrote about those early days in Skagway, said there was a family, a Tlingit family that lived over in Smuggler's Cove, which makes a whole lot more sense. It's a lot more sheltered than the Skagway Valley is. And then, of course, during the gold rush itself, the Tlingit that kind of hung around the town to get summer jobs were living up on that bench that's on the east side of the valley, kind of overlooking the town. Mm-hmm. And really, I don't see why any Tlingit that was sane would have been living where Moore decided he'd live. You know, it was very close at that time. It's very close to where the beach line was. In fact, I think he built pretty much right off at the tree line at that time.
Oh, interesting. It was that high.
The tidal
area was that far up?
The tidal area really extended a long way. And there was a lot of tidal grasses out in there that I think that he was using for his animals that he brought in. You know,
for
horses.
Grazing, yeah.
Mainly he was doing early packing over the White Pass Trail. Mm-hmm. And so he had a number of horses. And then I remember reading something that he had some pigs. Got upset at the farmers the stampeders letting his pigs out of the corral.
I mean, I knew the tidal area was farther up than it is now, but I didn't realize it went all the way up to Moorhouse. And then he was right by the creek, too, wasn't he?
Right. He was by the creek. And then I see the tidal area probably would have gone up to about where certainly 3rd Avenue is now.
Mm-hmm.
And 3rd would have been under the I'm going to turn that off if I can. There. In fact, I don't know if I can turn that off. I'll just have to do that if it rings again. I know that there's been pictures of the tide actually coming up above Third Avenue. Mm-hmm. And I think in 1901, and then in earlier pictures, you can see right where the Mascot Saloon is, that it was built up on piers because the tide would come up underneath the Mascot Saloon. That's why, to tell you the truth, I don't think that there could ever have been a tent on that location, because you can see the tide washing in underneath the...
Well, I suppose maybe a seasonal tent, maybe, with come up all the time. I don't know.
I think Ted and Paul thought maybe there was, you know, maybe during that first week or two, that the people were just putting tents in every which way. Right. And I suppose that's possible, but it seemed to me I found two or three artifacts that dated to 98, 99, rather, firmly embedded in that deposit, which to me tells me it couldn't have been late 97 tent.
Well, as you say, you put up a tent until it gets flooded, and then you realize that was not the best idea.
Right. So, you know, they could be right. Mm-hmm. But I still think the majority of the artifacts have to do with the building itself, you know, when after it became a saloon.
So any other surprises that you found in any of the projects about things you found, whether actually an artifact or just the larger story and context?
Oh, you know, the surprising stories came through the years as you'd sit back there and you'd think about it. And, you know, the statistical study I did for my dissertation, it was so cool seeing stuff fall into place and suddenly make sense. It's hard to even come up with any examples right now off the top of my head, but it just, to me that, and there was one artifact that later I realized the significance of, and that was a little wooden spoon that was found under the Mascot Saloon, which had been identified as a mustard spoon. It would have been a little wooden spoon that was put in a pot of mustard and was used to put the mustard on the sandwiches they were making for the free lunches in the saloons at the time. And because of the date when I found that the date of the deposit for the artifact, I realized that the saloon keeper at that time was Chris Shea. And Chris Shea later became, he became one of these people I got really fascinated with in terms of Skagway history. And I ended up writing an article about him for the Pacific Western Quarterly.
Yeah, North Pacific. Yeah, I know what you
Pacific
mean.
Pacific Western Quarterly, I think is what they call themselves. He was prominent in local politics, and it was just a real character. Newspaper editor didn't like him very well because he ended up being the head of the Labor Party, and got kind of a labor movement going in Skagway, and he was really a fascinating person, but I realized that Chris Shea probably picked up that spoon and held it and put it in the pot of mustard. And I was touching something that Chris Shea had touched. And it's so neat when you can really put an artifact with a person. Mm-hmm. And rarely, you never know that when you dig them up. You know, it's just, this is kind of cool. Oh, this is it. We'd all, at the end of the day, each day, we'd all sit around and talk about the best artifact we found. And then we'd vote for the best artifact of the day and the best artifact of the week.
Um, Well, I would think, though, if you were excavating, at somebody's house, like you knew it was the Moore's house, or you knew it was Father Tunnell's dump, you
Yeah.
couldn't make those same associations that this artifact had been held by this person.
Yeah, you could, but I think in the case of that mustard spoon, it wasn't until after I'd done all the research on Chris Shea, historic research, and I'd done a bunch of writing. I even wrote a novel about him, and I haven't ever gone back to it, but I was going to get Jeff Brady. He published that first historical novel I did, and Chris Shea shows up as a character in that novel. But I had done a follow-up novel about Chris, and so I thought that I knew him very intimately. And then to suddenly realize, oh yeah, I remember holding that
All
artifact,
right. Okay, I see. Yeah, it had a much more of a personal connection. Yeah. Well, we've been talking about all these great, wonderful joys of doing archaeology in Skagway. I'm going to switch it up a little bit and talk about what was more challenging or difficult during those days.
Well, it was always challenging finding a crew. That was, it was challenging in the very early days of learning to deal with the environment because it was so alien to what I was used to. It had never occurred to me that you don't want to go look at stratigraphy for 8 to 10 day hours at a stretch in late October in Alaska. It's just not going to work.
Because it's too
It's
dark to see the layers
too
down
dark.
below.
I mean, the sun comes up, but I it was like between 10 and 2 was the natural light was, and artificial light doesn't work very well. Working under the buildings was a very difficult prospect. And what has always been for me working in the for the Denver Service Center is you can get an architect to jack a building up so high, but there's something about at a certain point they say, no, I can't jack it up any higher, which means the archaeologist is crawling around on their hands and feet, or if they're standing up, they're banging their head, and it's dark. You can't get it. In fact, the first time I went up there, I said, well, you're going to replace the floor anyway. Will you take the floor out before I have to do the excavations? Well, no, we can't do that because it's not time right. And a lot of times they probably were right. I think the floor was structural too and helped hold the building together.
Right. Well, these could have cut a hole in the floor or something.
I did. I got them to cut a couple of holes in the floor of the depot for us. But it didn't always work out well. And so a lot of times you're just wearing your hard hat underneath the building and bumping, even then bumping it all the time.
And what kind of lighting did you have? Just flashlights, or did you have some lights set up down there?
We always set up lights of one kind or another. They weren't ideal. I think sometimes they were just bare light bulbs with, and you can see how yellow my picture is right now. My face is. It's because I've got a yellow colored light shining on me. And you'd have that under the buildings instead of what you really want is natural light or full spectrum light of some kind. And you can't get that kind of stuff in Skagway. You can't, by the time you could get it shipped up. Archaeology is always a challenge because you never know exactly what your conditions are going to be till you get there. And if it wasn't in the Skagway hardware store, you just may do without
And
it.
headlamps were not quite as fashionable and available as they are now.
We had headlamps, and I'm sure I used them. But again, it's you end up with yellow light. You don't ha In those days, it was always yellow. It wasn't a bright white light that would have really helped work.
And I never thought about that you could have actually even stood up under those buildings. I figured it was sort of crawling on your belly most of the
No,
time.
usually it was under your ha on your hands and knees. I've seen one picture of Paul Gleason. Excuse me. under the Mascot Saloon where he's standing, but I think he's standing in the pit that he dug. So most of the time you didn't stand under those buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to be a young person, you know. There's no way I'd be able to do that kind of stuff now. Back would kill me.
Yeah. And so those sort of some of the general challenges, and you had said, you know, the timing and getting archaeology thought of in the restoration process in advance. Were there any specific projects where you faced some hardships or difficulties? Or obstacles? People threw up obstacles at you?
Oh, I don't particularly remember any obstacles being thrown up other than just general ignorance. And it was a shared ignorance. So, you know, in retrospect, you could think, well, we could have coordinated better, or you know, I did find some superintendents easier to work with than other superintendents. Some didn't necessarily think that having archaeologists in there was going to give them anything, whereas others were. And to tell you the truth, I wouldn't even be able to remember all their names right now. So none of it really sticks out in my memory.
Well, I was thinking there weren't. I was thinking whether the restoration crews and the building guys were like, oh, these archaeologists, they're in the way, you know, they're slowing down our project, and come on,
the worst was taking the shovels and the wheelbarrows, and you know, that's a minor thing. So right.
You didn't feel like there was pressure to get your work done fast and get out of the way?
Well, I felt that pressure, but not from the individuals who were in Skagway. I was getting that pressure from my office and also from the regional office.
Well, that's good that the local construction crews were supportive. Actually, they may have, I've talked to some of them, and I think they kind of got a kick out of like, oh, let's see what we can find down there. That excited by neat artifacts that you guys found.
Yeah. Now, I did get, there would every once in a while would be some local people who would, I remember I was digging on the south side of the depot, and what I ended up finding down there was a cesspool or a septic tank. And somebody came up and laughing at me and saying, oh, we knew that was there all along. We wanted to see how long it'd take you to find it. And, you know, that's a little nasty.
Yeah.
and another time, you know, I was digging where I thought was going to be the foundation, the new foundation for the Boss Bakery. And was just putting in a real narrow 2 foot wide trench, about 10, 12 feet long, to just see what the ground kind of looked like down there. Well, the woman who owned the curio store right next door, the name will come to me real soon, but she got really upset. She said, you're on my property. You shouldn't be here. And I went and checked, and yes, I was over onto her property line by about 2 feet. So I quickly backfilled it and apologized. And but for the most part, the people would come by, and they always wanted to ask, they'd always ask if they could take my back soil, because I'd sifted it and it had some organic materials in them, and you know, it was prime planting material. And I'd have to say, no, I'm sorry, I gotta put it back in the hole. We can't just leave a hole here when we get done.
That's interesting. The avid gardeners of Skagway.
Yeah, the avid gardeners of Skagway, and there were several.
Well, it brings to the question about doing archaeology in a public space like downtown Skagway, and you know, not just the locals, but you know, the tourist trade was on the increase when you were there.
Yeah.
And experiences you might have had with you know, having to excavate in and around such a public space?
Oh, well, they, you know, every person that would come up at Klondike Gold Rush, every tourist would always ask the same question. And it was, found any gold yet? And so I'd explain what we were doing. I usually told the crew not to bother, you know, just go on working. And once the crowds got big enough, then the park started having the tours.
Oh, the walking tours.
The walking tours. And so that made it a lot easier for us because I could give a little introductory program to the,
because the ranger could,
to the park interpreters, and then they could do the little spiel for me. One of the funniest things was when Alice Sear was a interpreter for a couple of summers, and she'd bring her tour back, and she'd say, okay, everybody on cue at once, so we get it out of the way. Ask the archaeologist, have you found any gold yet? And then that would always make us laugh, right. You know. And then she'd do her little spiel and go on. Other times, if there weren't interpreters around, I got so I'd make up a little interpretive sign, handwritten interpretive sign, and put it on something nearby so that for the most part it would answer. And then if somebody had serious questions, I'd take the time to answer their questions because I felt like that's part of our mission.
Yeah. So. Well, I was going to say, yeah, to have your crew not answer questions, I would think the public might be a little offended if they were being ignored.
Well, my crew was almost always right near where I was anyway. So, yeah. So there'd be someone to answer their questions.
Yeah.
But I do remember another time we were using chain link fences that were in sections with the piping around them, mm-hmm. so that you could form a box,
right?
Basically, and we were using those to kind of protect the people from falling into our holes for one thing, and then make sure that they didn't get messed up at night, that sort of thing. So one of my crew members one time put a do not feed the archaeologist sign on the outside.
That's great. You gotta have a good sense of humor.
Yeah.
I said, well, you could eat the peanut shells from under the mask.
Yeah, right.
Did you ever do any of the archaeology out at Dyea, or was that all Carl?
That was all Carl Gerke did that.
Yeah.
So no, I didn't do any archaeology out there.
I didn't know if when they had, before they did the grid plan, if you had done anything, but I guess that was later when they did that. Well, one of the things you sort of hinted at it, but that in Skagway, a lot of buildings got moved around, and how that adds to the challenges of doing historic archaeology under them.
Well, usually, you know, because Bob Spooty had done that 10 structures report, we kind of knew what buildings, it wasn't like I'd go in totally ignorant mm-hmm. of, you know, I had him to rely on. He started doing his work there about a year before I first showed up. And then he was usually around in the summers for 2 or 3 years after that, and then was always available. And then we'd published that 10 structures report. And I had something written that I could go and, you know, look at the history of the piece of ground and the history of the building. His focused more on history of buildings,
right.
And so he would talk about where it was, when, and that sort of thing. I didn't always know what had been in the location of where the building was being moved to. For instance, the Boss Bakery
mm-hmm.
Had been just Park Service moved it to that location,
right.
And the Goldberg Cigar store, too, was moved onto its, now the Goldberg Cigar store has been moved 1,000 times just during the time it's been with the Park Service. But,
but so in a case like that, then do you excavate, well, in that case, so if it's being moved now, you can excavate before it gets moved.
Right, right. And I did that. I did that both for the Boss Bakery and for the cigar store. And because I did those early tests on Block 24, I said, please don't put the cigar store where you said you want to put it. And because you're going to mess up a whole bunch of archaeology. And in that case, they did. They followed through with that.
Well, I was thinking, you know, like you mentioned the Martin Itchen house. So it used to be one place and then it got moved. So were you able to do archaeology in both places?
No, not in its original location because it was privately owned. Okay. So the building was donated to the Park Service, but not the land on which the building stood. And, but we had an empty lot, so which was kind of similar to the place that the Martin Itchen house originally was, which was very close to the waterfront and close to where the docks would have been. And so that's why it ended up getting, in fact, I think the Martin Itchen house was actually on one of the docks to start with, historically.
It's across the street from the depot now, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
And so that lot it got put on, did that get investigated before it got put there?
Yes, yes.
And any...
I did some work there, and then I recommended there be further study there because of just the little tiny trench I did didn't give us enough information. And somebody else did that work through the regional office. The regional office hired some people to come and do that. And nothing really that I can remember. At one place they found impressions of tracks, and I can't remember if it was at that place or over where they put the maintenance facility.
But yeah, the reason I'm asking it is sort of the idea of you could do archaeology under a building that would show it was used this way when in fact the building on top of it isn't really that kind of a building.
Right, no. And so
do you deal with that?
Well, the way you deal with it is you just report what you found and tie it into its context. And so the archaeology at the Martin Itchen house location has nothing to do with the Martin Itchen house.
Right. But it could tell you what was maybe there before.
Right. Okay. Right.
Yeah. Just...
And yes. And I think they did finally, between looking at the archaeology and the pictures and the old photographs and that sort of thing, they figured out there was a little, it was a little shack of some kind sitting there, and I think it was used in conjunction with the depot and one, it might have been a storage shack or something like that.
Well, and in Skagway, having such a long documented historic record of the buildings in the town probably helps.
Oh, yeah. And see, my husband, Bob Spooty, one of his original tasks in Skagway was to, he took it upon himself to find every photograph he could in archives all over the country and in Canada and in private collections, just to build up a photographic collection for the park. And that collection has been expanded since he left, but I'll bet you still 75% of it is what he acquired for the park. And because the Kodak camera was the little
brownie. Kodaks.
Well, they weren't quite the brownies yet, but amateurs could take photographs. You didn't have to be professional in order to be able to take a photograph in those days. And so they're all over the place. And then the professional photographers also took wonderful photographs.
Yeah.
So And then there was a great collection, the Paul Sinzik collection of glass plate negatives was found there in Skagway. And had somebody was going to use the plate, the glass plates as for a greenhouse. And somebody finally said, no, maybe you ought to save those because those are pretty cool.
Yeah. Cool. So are there any excavations or projects in the archaeology realm that you wished you could have worked on that you weren't able to? Because I know you've gone on to do other things.
Yeah. You know, I think by the time I finished doing the work I did at Skagway, I was done. I was ready to move on to other things. It was very inconvenient. I loved going and spending a summer in Alaska every summer. At the same time, it always had to be about the time I was going to be growing my garden in Denver. I'd have to find somebody to weed my garden and water it all and that kind of stuff. So I was ready. By the time I moved down here, I was ready to start doing archaeology. One, in when it rained, I could go inside and didn't have to keep working. And two, that it was just a much more pleasant. I didn't have to go so far, you know, I could, you didn't take giant chunks out of my life.
Yeah. So did you ever think about living in Skagway, or why did you not end up living there?
In fact, before the park hired Carl and they were trying to create that position, was about the time I had gotten divorced from my first husband. And I remember talking to the Leslie Hart, who was chief of cultural resources at the time, and saying, you know, you could transfer me up there. I could be one of your regional archaeologists and just have me stationed in Skagway. And I thought that would be a kind of a dream job. But then they hired both Paul Gleason and Ted Burkadahl, both of whom had PhDs. And at that point, I had only a bachelor's degree. And that's when I realized, maybe it would behoove me to go back to school and get the rest of my education and that sort of thing. So I don't know if that answers your question, but emotionally, I would have been prepared to do it. It just, the park had, or the regional office had some really good candidates for the job too, and who would stay in Anchorage and do what they were supposed to be doing instead of playing in the dirt in Skagway, which I thought I wanted to do. Mm-hmm. So,
well, so when you and Bob got together, and did you end up living in Anchorage? I mean, he did, didn't he?
He did. We didn't start dating each other until he moved to Denver.
Oh, okay.
But we knew each other that entire time, you know, because I didn't even remember meeting him because I just had always known him. And then at one point I was going back through really old notes. I always kept a journal, a daily journal when I was on field trips. And looking back through my journal, I said, I can't tell you what the date was off the top of my head now, but I do have a note from 1978, October of 78 sometime, that said I met Bob Spooty, who's the historian at the park. But that's the only way I knew when I met him.
Right. But yeah, so you didn't actually live in Alaska during all this time on a
No, I never lived in Alaska. I'd be there 5-6 weeks at a time in the summer. I did do one. I went up to Skagway in the winter one time, But I don't think that wasn't even on official business. I think I paid my own way up there to do some research in connection with my dissertation or something.
Okay.
That I went up in January because I knew that nobody else would be wanting the microfilm reader. And I'd be able to, and then I did a lot of research also on the same subject in Juneau at both the state archives and at the history museum. I mean, the history library. Yeah.
I would assume that there are people who would think that the cost of doing all that digging in the dirt under those buildings would be... What did you get for that, all that money that was put into those projects, and why was it worth spending that money? What's your response to that criticism?
Well, the response to that is, you know, if it's the same response you have for any kind of compliance that we do. We have those laws for a reason, and it's... There, I've been involved not in the Skagway sense, but in other parks where the archaeology was not done correctly and or in a timely manner, and it did end up causing major problems. One was at Nez Perce National Historic Park. An archaeologist had given a clearance to do the a road into a new visitor center, and did not know how to read the engineering drawings right. So he didn't understand what a cut slope was. And he thought the impact area was gonna be right where the road was, and didn't realize the impact area was gonna be way off to, you know, because it was on the side of the hill, and he just didn't know how to read the drawing. And they ended up finding, going through a Nez Perce grave cemetery and dug up like 56 or 57 graves by bulldozer before that anybody happened to notice that there were human bones all over the place.
Oh,
and that project ended up costing, now we're talking 1978, again, the late 70s at that point, cost about $65,000 in archaeological work, which it was a tremendous amount in those days. But it also cost $1.5 million of delay costs to the contractor. And so these upfront costs, cumulatively may seem like a lot, but they still... takes a lot of just regular compliance to prevent a $1.5 million delay to the construction of the visitor center, not to mention what it did to the Nez Perce people,
right.
That was before NAGPRA, and you know, there were Nez Perce people coming out there and seeing the graves and seeing the bones, and just the psychological upset to the, and that's always been why I think it's important. You don't know really what's buried down there. And so you got to do your homework in one way or another.
Right. Well, and in that case, the negative relationship that would have reflected on the Park Service from the Nez Perce community, that probably really impacted that.
Yeah, I have no idea because I haven't ever read a administrative history or anything like that of that park, but I don't imagine that they got along very well with the Nez Perce for a while, despite the fact it's called Nez Perce National Historic Park.
Right.
And the Visitor Center is dedicated to interpreting the Nez Perce culture and, you know, that sort of things. So it just doesn't look good to the Park Service, and rightfully so.
Right.
Well, if you don't do what you're supposed to have done.
Right. And, you know, I was thinking, you know, that there's, my question was sort of related to, you know, the members of the public are thinking, you know, this is a waste of taxpayer dollars to be digging under these buildings. Who's ever going to see or care? But I was also thinking that the architects or the building construction people, sometimes there has been the, you know, oh, you're delaying the project. This is going to either add money and delay, or we want to get working now. You guys get out of the way.
I found that was true in the 70s and in the 80s, but as time went on, they began to realize that, hey, the archaeologists are finding something out that can help us with our interpretations, but both the historians and the historical architects. And by the time I left the Denver Service Center in 97, the architects and the engineers I was working with just really seemed to enjoy doing it. They'd get really fascinated by what we were finding, and they'd take it as a challenge to see if there's a way they could find a design solution to not impact the archaeology, you know. And
so maybe that just came with more education about
it was an education
historic thing. Preservation.
The guy who was the chief of the Western team, which we had planning, design, and construction divisions. So there were three divisions of each team. And Cal Cooper had been chief of engineering design when the Nez Perce incident took place. Then he became chief of the entire team. And he mandated that everybody talk to me. He was very supportive of my role, and he did not want another $1.5 million lawsuit to have to deal with, and he didn't want to have superintendents complaining about relations with Native American groups right. either.
So was the archaeology at Denver Service Center, were you under the planning?
I was in the planning division.
Yeah. And were you the only archaeologist, or were there other people there?
No, we, I'm trying to remember. It's terrible that I can't remember all their names, but at the time when, of the reorganization in 95, I became what was called a resources manager or something. Anyway, I was a kind of a supervisor for the historians, the archaeologists, and the one cultural anthropologist we had on the team. And between us, there were 13 of us. So I think there were five or six historians, the one anthropologist, and the rest of us were archaeologists. And many of those archaeologists were stationed back east. There was at least one other archaeologist on it at okay. all times.
So it was a pretty big team of people.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So you mentioned it briefly, and I'm going to ask about a little bit more, is the writing of the reports for the Skagway excavations, and that, what did it take, like 10 years to get those 10 volumes finished, or more than that?
A lot of that had to do with the fact that my duties were divided between the field work and the day-to-day working with compliance. And so, you know, you sit down to count sherds of glass, and in comes an architect saying, well, I've got this design project. How soon can you do the review and then talk to the archaeologists in Yosemite National Park, if it's the Yosemite project, and get so that we can get some estimates on how much it's going to cost to do the archaeology and that sort of stuff. And so it was constant interruption, which is, Paul Gleason and Ted Burkittall both recognized right away that was not a way to get reports finished. So that's one of the reasons, and I didn't protest at all when they said, we're going to start giving the field work to other people to do, but we will continue to.
Oh, you just froze up. Your Zoom just froze up. You may have to log off and log back on. I've lost you. Okay, so now we're back. Yeah, it was an internet issue, so we'll just keep going. So you were talking about the working on the reports and that Ted and Paul said they could assign the field work to other people?
Yeah, okay. In the archaeological industry as a whole, you're supposed to schedule three times as much time for analysis and writing of a report than you spend in the field. And that's including all the man hours in the field. So it is not unusual for a report to take 2 to 3 years to finish after the field work is done. And then when you get someone like me who was having to devote only half my time to doing the analysis and recording, that's why it took so long. You know, it just kept piling up.
And there was no deadlines or pressures that, hey, you know, we need your report so we can move forward?
No, because at that point, I'd always do a preliminary report as soon as I came in out of the field, which would give them the compliance information they needed. And all the final report did was fully document what it was I found.
Okay.
And interpret it.
Okay. That makes sense. I was thinking, yeah, you'd be holding up all these other stuff.
No, we weren't. And I always made sure they had the information they needed within a month or two of coming out of the field.
Okay. And so did you miss doing the field work in those years you were doing all that report writing?
No. I always enjoyed my work at the Denver Service Center, and it was a wide variety of work. I ended up traveling to every single park in the western half of the country to do on-ground coordination between planning and designing, and people who were going to be implementing the archaeological compliance portions of it. And then I even ended up in the planning branch doing some writing some planning documents myself, some special studies, special history studies. I did one for the Bear River Massacre site, which I was team lead on that, and I had to coordinate all entire team on how to do an environmental assessment for a special resource study. And those are fascinating things to do. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't miss having aching joints and getting cold and getting dirty all the time. I really did have a really wonderful job mm-hmm. in the Park Service.
Yeah, it sounds like it. And with the Skagway work, with Ted and Paul finding other people to do that excavation, they've somehow found money, because your work was all paid out of Denver, so they must have found money regionally.
Well, I think the money was still connected to the Denver projects, but the money would be allocated directly to the regional office instead of to the Denver Service Center.
Okay.
Like I said, there are certain types of money. There's right. archaeological fund research money, which is type 42 money. There's archaeological salvage or monitoring money, which is type 43. And then I don't know all the other types of money, you know, the design monies, the interpretive right. report, all that. You know, the furnishing studies are in a different type. You know, it's kind of like the interpretive work that's done there used to be coordinated out of the Harpers Ferry right. Interpretive Center. So
right.
Denver Service Center was just the design and construction center.
Okay. Well, must have felt good to get all those reports finally done.
Oh, it's
like 10 of them, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It felt really good. And then I went on to do other things here for the Southwest. I was like the principal investigator of a park-wide survey for Natural Bridges National Monument, and then I did the National Register nomination for the for an archaeological district for that. I did a number of little projects, just clearance projects for the region. And then after I retired, I went to work for a couple of consulting firms. I did did some field work and for a company out of Tucson, Arizona on a 1916 National Guard campsite.
Wow.
that was interesting.
Yeah.
And then I wrote a research design for a company out of Albuquerque that was working with EPA and the Forest Service on doing some mine cleanup in Idaho.
Huh.
You know, so I got to do other things.
Yeah.
So long after Skagway.
Yeah. When did you retire?
I retired in 2005.
Okay. And when was the last project you worked on in Skagway? Was in the mid-90s?
I think the last report, the last field work I did was in 91. And then that the Mascot Saloon report, when did that get published?
I think 2005.
That's right. The Mascot Saloon, I was working on till the day I retired.
Yeah, that was the last one. Yeah. That's volume 10.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and Father Turnell is 93.
Yeah, 90. Father Turnell, I was pregnant. And my daughter and I had figured out exactly how long it would take me to finish the draft on the first draft on that. And it was the final draft. My daughter came 3 weeks early.
Oh no.
And I wasn't quite ready to to take 6 months of work to leave from work. So I in that first month or so after she was born, I tried to do some writing and what I had to from home. As she was napping, and I quickly discovered that I needed to take a couple of weeks rest first before right. I did that. But I did finish that report while I was on maternity leave.
Yeah, and 83 was when the depot report was done, volume one. So it was from 83 to 2005.
Yeah.
Which is a long time.
Yep.
We talked about retirement, and I know since retirement you've gone on to do other things. You mentioned writing novels and other sort of more historical works instead of archaeology. Can you talk a little bit about that stuff?
Well, the first thing I really had wanted to do when I retired was I wanted to write. And mm-hmm. I had long ago discovered that what I liked about doing archaeology far more than the field work was writing it all up and putting it, making sense out of it. And I'd had that El Dorado book, the concept of it for some time before I retired, and had actually started trying to do some work on it on weekends and evenings, and just couldn't
right.
devote the amount of time I needed to. So that was part of my impetus for retiring. Because I just felt so strongly that that book needed to be done. And so then I worked with Robin and Carl Gerke, and we got Rick Sprague, who at the time was a very, very well known in the historical archaeological field. And all he did was really do our bibliography for us, or our references cited. But he'd been an editor of one of the journals, historical journals out there. So he really was good in terms of pulling all that data together for us. That's what I worked on as soon as I retired. And then I also had been wanting to write that book on the prostitutes mm-hmm. of Skagway ever since I did my dissertation, because I'd gotten so much really cool information out of the newspapers about the prostitutes. So it was about that same time I started writing the first draft of my Prostitutes and Saloons book. And that manuscript, because I'd never really done an academic book before in history, it didn't get published until it went to its fourth publisher.
No.
And I was actually, it was glad, because University of Oklahoma Press is a very, very good press and very prestigious. And the places that turned it down earlier were like the University of Alaska Press, who I guess had Lael Miller.
Lael Morgan.
Lael. Yeah. But who wrote the Good Time Girls book?
Yeah, Lael Morgan.
Yeah, yeah. They had her as a peer reviewer, and she later told me that she wasn't going to pass on my book because it would compete with hers. And then I sent it to the University of Washington, and they made the mistake of asking Lael Morgan. And I wised up after that. Yeah. And when I sent it to the University of Nevada Press, Reno, asked them not to include Lael in their review. And by that time, I was getting really focusing on a Goodreads book. And then they chose not to publish it because I'd failed to reference somebody, the person that they use for their peer reviewer.
Oh, the politics.
So I promptly went out, bought his book, and integrated it into mine. And then Oklahoma said, yes, it's perfect.
Good. Well, and then you went on to write, as you say, you've been writing novels as well.
Well, oh, yeah. When I first retired, I was on I wrote like 13 manuscripts of novels and didn't have the foggiest idea what I was doing. And the only one that I really did anything with was that one for Skagway. And it was based on, are you still there?
Yep. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. It's just the screen changed.
Oh, okay.
For some reason.
So the novels, so why novels? Why did you decide to tackle novel writing?
Just because they were fun. And that one I did for Skagway was based on a couple of real people in Skagway. And, you know, it was the saloon, classic saloon owner and madam love story. And I couldn't resist it. But it was based on, you know, real things that I'd learned in the process of trying to put that Prostitutes and Saloons book together. And the data for the saloons part of it, I was pretty much all part of the background material I did for the Mascot Saloon Report, trying to put it into context.
So as a historian and archaeologist, is it challenging to write fiction?
You know what? I'm going to start another fiction book because it's been, 15 years now since I poured out a whole bunch of really poor, terrible manuscripts. And I've gone to a lot of Western Writers of America meetings. I've taken some community college courses, and I've read some books, and I think I could do it much better now after all the writing that I've been doing for academic presses. Fiction is fun, but it's also, in my mind, I only want to do historical fiction, and I want to do it based on real stories. So they take almost as much work in terms of research. And then it's an entirely different challenge because you have to have a point of view for the book, and you have to be seeing the story through the eyes of one or more of the characters in the book. So it's fun. That's why I think it's fun, is because then you get to suddenly start thinking, what would this person have really been thinking about? And how would they have been reacting to these events? And how do you put these events that seem to be so all disconnected into a smooth story?
I was thinking it would be harder, the idea of making up things instead of using facts, that as a trained historical person, if that becomes difficult.
Yeah, and see, that's it. I guess I'm not imaginative enough to come up with a plot line by myself, and having a historic plot line is made for a skeleton. But then the problem is that there's far too many parts, and that you don't want to complicate the story with. So then it becomes a challenge to figure out what you need to dispose of. In one draft novel I wrote, I combined two or three real characters into one. just because it got too confusing, and those three people were fulfilling the same role of antagonist. So, you know.
That makes sense. Well, I'm going to kind of try and wrap things up a little bit here. Then we could talk forever. But looking back at your work in Skagway, is there anything that you consider your biggest accomplishment or you're most proud of?
Oh, you know, my Mascot Saloon report, I think, being the last is always the best, in terms of what I was paid to do. But I think what I felt best about was being able to put out the academic books I've written since. And because to me, those make the contribution and are the things that other scholars are going to read. And even if the tourists never find out about the prostitutes in the saloons, which I think they should. That's the problem with getting a academic press, is that, of course, they want to put it in hardcover, and then it's too expensive for the tourists to buy.
Anything that you, looking back, you might have done differently along the way?
Oh, well, I think those first few times I went out there, I would have gone out to spend a couple weeks ahead of time to do the historic research that needed to be done. But considering the time and the place and general knowledge in the profession, I don't kick myself too badly for it, because I don't think I was any worse than anybody else was. So
what was I just going to ask about? Overall, your feelings about having done that work in Skagway, you're glad you did it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was a great career. But I was also glad that I had the opportunity to do so many other things. I would not have wanted to become Carl Gerke, for instance. I need a little bit more variety than that.
Yeah. Well, in terms of sort of a legacy question, I mean, your name is certainly associated with lots of archaeology in Skagway. You know, anytime you talk about building archaeology, your name comes up. How do you feel about that reputation or legacy?
Well, I'm glad that people remember me and remember that I was out there and doing stuff. I'm just glad that I was able to make a difference in the Park Service too.
Do you feel like there's any techniques or approaches, strategies that you implemented that people are still doing? Your dissertation, you mentioned that planning model, but other things that you think other people have sort of followed in your footsteps to, in terms of, I guess, practices, best practices?
You know what? I really don't know, because 95 was about the last time I had any major interaction with what was going on in Alaska. And then when I moved in here in 97, the types of archaeology I was doing was the whole milieu was different mm-hmm. than it had been out of the Denver Service Center. And things changed a lot in the Park Service as a whole in 95 with the reorganization, which means that I think by becoming decentralized, people were also, or cultural resources people were becoming insular and not networking to the extent that we'd been able to do when we had a central office. Mm-hmm. For instance, I was instrumental in setting up a series of annual meetings of archaeologists in all Western parks, where we would all get together once a year under the kind of the guise of coordinating with my the Denver Services Center's design and construction projects, because I'd sit down with each archaeologist and spend a 2 or 4 hours with them going through the projects and what was going to needed to be done and that sort of thing. But it also then provided a 2 or 3 day conference time in which all park archaeologists in those parks that could attend our meetings would exchange information and exchange problems they were having and solutions they were coming up with and that sort of thing. I know that died in 95. And especially as it become more and more decentralized, I mean, a park archaeologist doesn't have the budget to go on something like that the way a regional archaeologist does. Mm-hmm. And compliance as a whole was getting less and less and less funded. And I suspect since I retired in 2005, that it's only gotten worse for cultural resources and not better in terms of, so it may be I was, able to do what I was able to do in a time that was almost a golden age for cultural resources and stuff in the National Park Service.
Well, I'd say certainly for Skagway, you know, being in there, excuse the pun, but being there on the ground floor.
Yeah.
Probably helped. This is somewhat of an aside, but you were talking about it, made me think about this, about, you know, archaeology in the past has been a fairly male-dominated profession. I don't know what that was like in the 70s when you started, and how any experiences you had with that.
Oh yeah, when I first started, I naively didn't even realize how few the women archaeologists there were. I mean, I realized when I was in undergraduate school that the professors were treating the women on the crews as eye candy more than anything else. But I quickly learned that when I would travel, some of my first projects were in the South. And when I would travel in the South by myself, I couldn't get service in a restaurant. I couldn't get a decent room at a motel.
Wow.
Because doing excavations in Harper's Ferry, the tourists would come by and tell me I was taking jobs away from their husbands. So this all kind of shocked me, but then when I get back to the office, I was treated as a professional. So I didn't let that kind of stuff worry me too much. But even when as late as the early 90s, I was probably one of two of the top graded women archaeologists in the National Park Service. And so there just weren't that many of us. I don't know what it is today, because coming out of anthropology departments, it's predominantly female. And I would have thought there'd be far more female archaeologists today than there would be men. You don't need a lot of strength to do the job.
Yeah. I don't know what the numbers are now. Yeah. The fact that in 1978 you were selected as a woman archaeologist to come up to Skagway and do that work, I find interesting.
Well, I think I was one of the few people who knew anything about doing historical archaeology, and the guys that were working in the regional office, to their credit, knew they knew absolutely nothing. they could slog across the tundra and find archaeology sites, but they wouldn't know a red wear shirt from a white wear. So I think that they were glad to have somebody else doing what they saw was inferior archaeology anyway.
And there was were there male archaeologists out of Denver that could have been sent?
Evander?
No, in Denver.
Were there
male archaeologists that could have gone to Skagway?
Oh, there could have been, but I think that I was the only one that was, my Harpers Ferry work was up, and, I pretty much finished that work, and I was looking for a long-term project, and they said, so it was scheduling, you know.
Okay.
I think it was just that I was the one that was available at the time.
Okay. Well, this has been great fun talking to you. You probably have many other things to go on to do today, but just to wrap it up, is there anything else that I haven't asked about or that you wanted to talk about and make sure gets included as part of your story and memories?
Oh, not really. I didn't get a chance to tell you why I did the Soapy Smith book.
Oh, tell me why you did the Soapy Smith book.
The Soapy Smith book I did because one person historically that I kept running into as I was doing my historic research for all of the projects in Skagway was a guy by the name of Cy Tanner, who was a U.S. Deputy Marshal at the time of the Soapy Smith incident. And I wanted to do Cy's biography. I started to do it and I realized I was writing more about Soapy Smith than I was about Cy. So I did the Soapy Smith book.
Okay.
To get it out of the way. And I'm still working on Cy Tanner's biography, but that'll be the next book that I have to publish, is a biography of Cy Tanner. And he ended up becoming a U.S. Marshal, appointed as a U.S. Marshal, and he spent his entire career in Alaska doing involved in either the enforcement of the law or the creation of law through legislative efforts, or in the interpretation of law, because he was a magistrate and then a judge and stuff like that. So,
well, that sounds great. Yeah, I worked on a project where it occurred to me that we hear very little about sort of the law enforcement side of the gold rush.
Right. And
You hear about the Mounties and the Canadian side, but not so much on the U.S. side.
On the U.S. side, and that's right. And I do, and I'm going to devote an entire chapter, or I think I've already written it, in Cy's biography, to the difference between the Mounties and the U.S. and kind of the challenges that law enforcement had during the Gold Rush period in Skagway. And why it was really, the challenges were actually American, part of the American value system, you know,
yeah.
has a lot to do with independence and democracy and stuff like that, and not the top-down sort of thing that the British and the Canadians were doing. So,
right. Interesting. Well, that sounds like a fun next project.
Yeah.
Or current project. Yeah, well, and anything else that, you know, when I broached the subject of doing this an interview that you thought, oh, well, that's a great opportunity to talk about this or that or anything else you've thought of?
No, I was just glad that somebody wanted to remember. I mean, I hate it when I can't come up with people's names. The archaeologist there in the regional office, that Becky Salibi, did a really nice overview of all the archaeology through the years in Skagway. And it was, I was so glad that she was able to do that. So,
yeah. And I have interviewed her. So there is a record of about her putting together that project.
Good. Good.
Yeah. Okay. Well, as I say, I could talk to you much longer, but I think we'll kind of wrap it up.
Okay.
If that's all right with you.
That sounds great. And I really enjoyed talking to you.
Well, I enjoyed talking to you too. I'm sorry we couldn't have done it in person, but this is currently the next best thing.
Yeah. Well, it's the way of this age, so.
Okay, I'm going to turn off the recording.